This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and Matthew Rushing, my co-host, is not with me this week. We took a week off last week because Matthew is away, and he's still away as he's working to fortify the great northwest of the United States against a possible Dominion invasion. At least that's what he's told me he's doing, although he did tweet a picture of a hamburger earlier. Called Killer Burger, and I'm not so sure what's going on there. But I'm being joined today by a guest. Sitting in for Matthew is Daniel Handlin. Daniel, welcome to The Orb.
Hi, Chris. Great to be here.
It's great to have you on, and I'm so happy that you were willing to sit in with me here on the show today and fill in for Matthew. And also, you suggested a very interesting topic for our discussion. We're going to talk about the Cardassian underground and how Cardassian society and the way the government treats its people fosters this resistance. From time to time, you get these resistance movements that pop up, which of course we see culminate in the end of the series when Damar really works to eliminate the Dominion influence. But of course, this goes back long before the Dominion ever came into the picture. Daniel, tell us about your thoughts on this topic. You suggested this, as I mentioned. You did a wonderful outline for the show today. Tell us what got you thinking about this as a topic of discussion.
Well, Chris, it seems to me that throughout the series that the Cardassian government and society is structured in such a way that the only way to express dissent against the government and the military seems to be basically through these underground resistance movements. And it's a phenomenon that we see popping up over and over again, as we'll discuss, as early as the first season. You see dissidents like Eamon Maritza in Duet. And then later on through the show, you get Nateema Lang. And of course, the best known leaders are Tikhany Gamor and Damar, who has such a prominent role in the ending of the Dominion War. And it's both something that pops up again and again. And one thing that struck me was there's an episode where Garak is talking to Dr. Bashir, and he mentions that the greatest form of Cardassian literature is the repetitive epic. And it seemed to me that this is a repetitive cycle of resistance movements, and made me wonder if it's not even just the Cardassian government that is structured to produce these movements, but maybe it's something that's buried deeper in Cardassian psychology that leads to these sorts of resistances coming up again and again over time.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It could be. It does feel like something that could be cultural in that sense, because, as you say, that is the theme in the literature. And typically when themes repeat themselves in literature, or if something is the basis of an artistic art form in a culture, it does often stem from something underlying in the psyche of those people.
Yeah, and it's something that you see not just within the culture itself, but within individuals throughout the show. You have people who are fiercely dedicated to the government, for example, Damar or Garak in his earlier incarnations, who you know, later through the evolution of the various political events end up turning against those governments. And it seems to me that if someone so dedicated to the Cardassian government as its leader, someone like Damar or even Dukat in the Way of the Warrior, where he's involved in the coup against the ruling council at the time, it just seems like a feature of the Cardassian society and psychology that leads them to continually rise up in these sorts of rebellion movements against their government rather than the more sedate political discussion or opposition that we see in the other Alpha Quadrant powers or in real life here on Earth.
Yeah, I see that too. And I think that it was at least set up to present the Cardassians as more of the structured military state as opposed to the others. I know that some of the themes for characters with the Cardassians, with Tekkeni Gamor, for example, were modeled a bit after Germany, and maybe some of the resistance to Hitler, where as I see the Romulans and their political interplay being a bit more like a Soviet type, sort of this espionage intrigue. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes. And then, of course, the Klingons are a bit more of the Japanese samurai type culture.
Yeah, Chris, it's interesting that you should mention that because I was thinking especially of that comparison between the Romulan treatment of their underground movements versus the Cardassians. Obviously, you see with like an Eamon Maritza early on the parallels between the way the Cardassian state is set up and Nazi Germany. And what I was thinking was when you look at an episode like Unification from TNG, the Romulans have these underground movements, but the two differences that I see are first that they're not so much dedicated to overthrow of the Romulan government as they are to sort of introducing this new or alternate idea of unification or reconciliation with the Vulcans. And also, it seems to me that the Romulans are more willing to tolerate the existence of that movement and see it through to its natural conclusion, as you see with Pardak, who is willing to shepherd this movement along for quite a while to kind of see what he could get out of it, as opposed to the Cardassians, right, where it seems like as soon as they discover, for example, in Gamor's case, that he is leading the opposition, they create this elaborate ruse with Kira to try to unmask and arrest him.
Right, exactly. They're more willing to see where it might lead and what they can get out of it. They can always snuff it out if they need to, but if there could be some gain in it for them, why not let those involved play the game and let it play out?
Yeah,
and maybe
exactly.
You make it work for you.
Yeah, which seems totally counter to the Cardassian philosophy, where they always seem to regard every such movement as a mortal, immediate threat that has to be crushed without delay. Which,
right,
you know, again, maybe is again like if you take the comparison to Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, if you opposed Hitler and Nazi Germany, you were just shot. Whereas at least in the post-Stalin Soviet Union era, they would just put you in charge of some factory in Siberia. And never have you seen again, but it definitely is a different approach.
Yeah. Although the Cardassians will also exile people. I mean, Garak himself has been exiled, but it's done in almost a malicious way, right? It's because they feel that doing this would cause you more pain than just eliminating you outright.
Yeah, and for Garak, I think that's probably true. Although, on the other hand, I think it is unclear why exactly Garak has exiled, and maybe it is something more personal with the Nabrantane or the Obsidian Order. It's a little hard to say in his case, but definitely you do see that they have this habit of exiling people who it seems the last thing that they want is to be exiled from Cardassia.
Yeah. I also see a lot of, because I live very close to them, North Korea, in the Cardassian way, where if there's a threat, just eliminate it. You know, you don't tolerate any kind of uprising whatsoever, which makes me wonder, do you feel that the Cardassian government truly is fearful that if they allow anything to take hold, then it will snowball on them?
It does seem to be. And even within the show, I guess it's not really cast as part of the underground so much as it is as part of the changeling plots. But in The Way of the Warrior, the military council is overthrown in favor of civilian government, which may well have been due to a movement like this. And as we were talking about earlier with the apparently repetitive nature of Cardassian history, it may be that this is how Cardassian governments repeatedly get overthrown. Whether that says more about the effectiveness of these extremely authoritarian Cardassian governments or is just something innate to Cardassians is hard to say, but certainly from an earthly perspective, history tells us that when you establish a totalitarian government like that, that inevitably will get overthrown by such a movement, if not by an external invasion.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's talk about some of the people involved. Maritza is, I think, the first Cardassian that we see like this. It's actually where, for me, Deep Space Nine starts to become Deep Space Nine, the episode Duet, next to last episode of season one. And Maritza is determined that through, I guess you would say it's a self-sacrifice, that he is going to try to push some kind of change in Cardassian society to try to get them to take some responsibility for what they did to the Bajorans during the occupation. Where do you see Maritza playing into this? Because what we're going to talk about here is, again, we set it up here. What is Cardassian culture like? And what are the possible cycles like? And then we'll get to the end where Damar has actually spearheaded a change.
Yeah. So one thing I thought was interesting when you look at Maritza and his motivations is how they differ from what we might think of as the potential motivations of a dissident or defector from Cardassian society, because he never seems to be concerned with making Cardassia more like the Federation or creating a democracy, but his only goal is to affect the or improve the ethics and morality of the Cardassian people. And I think it's interesting, as we'll talk about with the other defectors, I think one constant thread that you do see running through them is that their main concern is with what they see as best for Cardassia in the long run, not so much the embrace of different political systems as we might think of, like, for example, with Cold War defectors. But he definitely, his sacrifice is because he perceives this ethical and moral deficiency in the Cardassians after they pull out from Bajor and their refusal to apologize or reconcile with the Bajorans in any way. And again, it's something, as you know, as we said before, the system is not set up to allow him to express that idea in any other way. But by the spectacle of this trial, which would presumably be impossible to hide, it is a way for him to express this alternate viewpoint that maybe the morality of his society is under threat.
Do you see, I'm just thinking of this as we're talking right now, do you see any similarities to Edward Snowden in this?
I don't. I think the situations are different. In Snowden's case, I think you could make an argument that he's leaking files indiscriminately solely with the goal of just causing damage to the government, and maybe he thinks what the government is doing is wrong, but I think it's hard to compare that to taking responsibility for what is a very obvious allusion to the Holocaust. Yeah. I think it could be seen in that way, but I see them as very different cases.
Yeah. Well, I'm not thinking anything related to the Holocaust here, because that's obviously something very, very different. But it just popped in my head as you were talking, just in the idea of trying to expose something that the person feels the government is doing wrong and that it needs to be exposed in order to affect some kind of change. And that's what Maritza is doing in some respects here. And he also, you know, ends up in exile from Cardassia. As a result of this, of course, he ends up dying at the end of the episode as well.
It's interesting, I guess, now that you say it, I guess I could see, I think at least Snowden thinks of himself as having similar goals to what Maritza claims to have. Whether he does or not, I guess, is open to debate or interpretation, but I think he would probably argue that, like Maritza, his goal is changing the ethics of our society. Although it's interesting that in the three Well, so if you look at someone in our world like a Snowden or an Assange, it's interesting that the governments that they end up seeking asylum from do tend to be more authoritarian or less free to the press, whereas Maritza goes to the Federation, which is obviously much more so. So it's an interesting difference between the world of Deep Space Nine and our world.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, I don't know what I think about it either. It just popped in my head at this moment as being an interesting connection. And it's one of the great things about DS9 that right now talking about it, here's something new to think about because, again, I've been watching these episodes for so many years and already have so many points about them.
I think that's one of the strengths of DS9 and good science fiction in general that, you know, obviously they had no idea that Edward Snowden was going to exist when they were writing these episodes, but even now you can take new meaning out of them and apply them to those real world situations.
Definitely. So that's Maritza. Now there's also Natima Lang, who was a professor and also a member of the Cardassian dissident movement, and interestingly was romantically involved with Quark. And Lang, for me, is one of these people who I could see in our own world, who are the intellectual, I don't want to use the word elite, but they're the intellectual members of society, professors in universities, and so who will work to affect change, but do it in a more measured or maybe quiet way because of the fact that they are academics in the first place.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Certainly, she seems less willing to sacrifice her own life than certainly a Maritza or you know, even the later Gamor and Damar. She seems to be concerned that, you know, she's going to be imprisoned or executed or otherwise by the Cardassians, whereas it seems to me, certainly in Maritza's case, his leaving the Cardassian Union is sort of the linchpin of his whole concept of resistance. And in Gamor's case, which we see later, it's, I think, forced, but more so that he can continue to lead his rebellion. So she definitely seems to be, I think, more, as you were saying, a maybe an ivory tower type, less experienced in running actual rebellion. And, you know, maybe the fact that we never see her again means that her style of attempting to run or be involved in an underground dissident movement was less effective, at least within the Cardassian context and these other leaders.
Yeah, I think that's the case with her. I don't think that her approach will work within Cardassian society. Her approach might work in Romulan society.
Yeah, I think that was. I think for the Romulans, it certainly would be more effective, as they, coming from the Vulcans and having their own set of philosophers, would probably be more receptive to, you know, a famous academic. So I guess bringing again that comparison you mentioned earlier, like a Sakharov or a Solzhenitsyn in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Whereas certainly there weren't any figures like that in the German resistance. You know, for example, in the plot to kill Hitler, it was led by military officers like Rommel and von Stauffenberg, I think, was the leader of the plot. So yeah, it's a different kind of person who leads rebellions in these various kinds of societies.
Yeah. And not just the academic aspect of it with Vulcans and then the Romulans being an offshoot of them, but just the devious nature, the scheming behind the scenes of Romulan society seems to fit her a lot better as well. I think with the Cardassians, you have to be direct and bold or you're going to be eliminated.
Yeah, there's certainly much less subtlety to Cardassian political maneuvering. And that's something you see with, for example, in Impact Nor, when Garak plays that game with O'Brien, he talks about, I think, how the game is one of bold strategies. I forget the name of that board game that he plays with him, but I think it's a similar reflection of Cardassian psychology in that way.
Yeah, right. Now, the first real leader of a dissident movement is Tekkini Gamor, who you mentioned a little bit earlier. And Gamor has a long story to his involvement and can be seen as someone who... Would you say that the actions of Gamor ultimately perhaps inspire Damar when it's time for him to take action?
Well, it's interesting. I was torn about this because on the one hand, it's certainly a similar end result. But on the other, I think that both their approach and their results were a little different. In Gamora's case, he does seem to be, I think his main idea is that the central command and the way that they're ruling is bad for Cardassia. Whereas Damar, I think, really embraces that and was more concerned with the Dominion encroachment upon that system rather than the central command per se.
Yeah.
Also, one thing that you see, which is definitely, I think, probably a topic that could take up its own show, but as I was mentioning before, when you, in the way of the warrior, when that government, when the military government is overthrown and replaced with a civilian one, that which leads to the intrigue with the Cardassians and the Dominion. One could argue that that has later implications for setting up the prelude to the Dominion War and possibly has negative consequences for the Cardassians. So certainly not his intention, but I think the results of what Gamor set in motion may have been very negative for the Cardassians in the long term. On the other hand, to sort of play devil's advocate against what I just said, when Damar is running his resistance movement, he has this friend Gul Rusat who wants to steal the Breen weapon that they are able to acquire and use it to make Cardassia great again rather than to bring down the Dominion. And Damar shoots him and says that his Cardassia is gone and it's not coming back, which right. leads me to think he is, at least maybe by that point, has come around to a more Gamor style of thinking that a wholly different government method is needed.
That's what I was thinking about when I asked the question, I believe, because as you said, after I asked you the question and you described the difference between the two of them, I think you're absolutely right that Damar was perfectly happy with the way the government was and his place in the government as long as it was the Cardassian government up until the Dominion became involved. And I think you can see with Dukat's involvement, things started changing and maybe not for the better of Cardassia, even before the Dominion came into the picture. But after that, of course, everything changed and someone had to step up or else Cardassia would have been wiped out. Before that, though, Damar was comfortable. Gamor wanted to effect change. But that moment, yes, when Damar says his Cardassia is gone forever, it's not coming back, that's the moment that signaled for me that Damar had changed. And it does reflect. Now, I don't think Damar wants to install a Federation-style government on Cardassia. But he wanted to throw off the shackles of the Dominion, obviously. But then probably would have installed some sort of government. And I'm going to, you know, keep the novels and stuff out of this, just what we know from the screen, because we don't know what really happened beyond this on television. He probably would have installed some sort of government that was not a democracy in the way we think of a democracy, but was not the militaristic, totalitarian type government that Cardassia had in the past.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Like if you look at someone like a Gorbachev, he also, I think, did not want to install a Western democracy, but he wanted right. to fundamentally reform his own system. And as you were saying, I think early on, Damar's point motivations are obviously he hates the Dominion. I think part of it is just he feels that he's personally disrespected by them. And he's obviously not a great moral paragon. You know, he murdered Zial, but at the same time, I think what he learns through working with Kira and the Federation and fighting the Dominion does lead him to come around to that viewpoint. And I don't know if it's necessarily a huge improvement to go from a system that's like Nazi Germany to a system that's like late era Soviet Union, but it's probably better. And I think he does at least get moved that far by the experiences that he has when fighting against the Dominion. So yeah. He definitely does have a change of heart. And I think by the Damar we see at the end of the series, probably I could see him working hand in hand with someone like Gamor.
You know, it's interesting. My studies in university, my degrees in Russian, and my studies were, and I was in school during the Soviet times. I actually was in Moscow during the coup when really? Gorbachev was overthrown. I was studying music at Moscow State Conservatory. And what you say about, you know, late Soviet era society in the Soviet Union, and how things can take on a life of their own and unravel, and you're trying to reform your society or your government, and you don't know where that's going to lead. In some cases, and I'm not going to speak for actual Russian people living there right now, but just if you look at it overall and you see what's going on with Russia right now, what Gorbachev did and what Yeltsin did and then maybe failed to follow through on set up Putin coming to power, but did not put the framework in place. And now you see what we have with Putin right now, which actually is taking the society backwards yet again. So how people like Gomor or Damar play into these events within their society is really, really fascinating thing about Deep Space Nine.
It is, and it's something you also see. I think both Russia and the Cardassians are prone to allowing themselves to be heavily influenced by individuals. Yeah. Certainly in both cases, you see these strong men rising up again and again. In Cardassia's case, Dukat very quickly and apparently without much resistance takes control when the Dominion comes in with him. And obviously you see that with Russia and Putin. It's definitely an interesting parallel between the two societies.
It definitely is. So that's Gomor. Are there any other aspects of Gomor? Because as I said, he actually has a long story within Deep Space Nine. We see him in Second Skin. That's, of course, when they do try to flush him out by kidnapping Kira and altering her to appear Cardassian, trying to convince Gomor that Kira is his lost daughter, Ileana. And it's being done, again, just to flush him out as a leader of this resistance. And then he comes back around again. We see him in Ties of Blood and Water. And at that point, we actually do see Dukat and Wayun coming to him. And it's something that even in this situation where maybe he doesn't pose that much of a threat to them anymore, they still won't let it go. They're still determined to, I feel like, to capture him at the end. I mean, Dukat kind of presents it like, you're dying, you're Cardassian, we want you to come back to Cardassia and have your final days there. But it still seems like even that is part of a final push by the Cardassian government to crush opposition.
Yeah, it's interesting that you should say that. Ties of Blood and Water is one of my favorite episodes and could probably fill a whole episode by itself just discussing what happens there, but they're just focusing on Gomor. One of the interesting things I thought in that episode was that as you said, Dukat and Wayun come to try to tempt him back to Cardassia, and one of the things they dangle in front of him is the chance to see his daughter again. They claim they've located her, and of course one assumes that they're lying, but as we've seen from Gamor's mental state, I think he is a man who would grasp at nearly anything to see his daughter again. And the fact that he puts the legacy of his movement above his family and his daughter, who we've seen he cares so deeply about, I think says a lot about his dedication to the resistance movement and his character. He's definitely, I think, one of the more well-rounded Cardassians that we see, and he in that way displays some characteristics that we might not ordinarily associate with Cardassians. And it's interesting to compare, for example, with Dukat, where initially he wants to kill Zial when he learns of her because of the effect that it would have on his career. So it's sort of the inverse of what we see with Gomor later.
Right. And for Gomor, at the end there, having to work with the Dominion was something that he simply could not swallow. That was just too much, too high of a price for him to pay there at the end. And as you talk about his character, and as we transition now to talk about Damar, it's what I see in Damar as well. Not early on, of course. Damar has one of the great turnarounds in character in Deep Space Nine, as we get into the final chapter, which of course Matthew and I are talking about over the course of the past few months. But you get the feeling, like with Gamora, that Damar also cares about the people.
He does.
It's not about him. It's about the Cardassian people. And that's what's such a big difference between any of these people that we talk about on Earth. Dictators, leaders of, maybe you don't want to call them dictators per se, but they're definitely, they have no patience for any kind of opposition. You know, it's all about them. It's about their power. It's just, it's something about what drives people who seek power. You see it in Kai Winn too, you know, people who seek power in DS9. But with Damar, I feel like he also comes to care about people and is willing to sacrifice himself for them, just as Gamora does. And as we just talked about here, Gamora giving up a chance to possibly, and I do think they were lying about it, but giving up a chance to possibly see his daughter again, that's sacrificing himself too.
Yeah, it's interesting in Damar's case. I think it's hard to see the person that he becomes at the end of Deep Space Nine and argue that his main concern is anything but the Cardassian people as a whole. And you, when you compare how Damar came to power to some of the other leaders that we've been talking about, I think Damar really was thrust into power. He was the most loyal follower of Dukat right into the final chapter, even after his various ways in which he's disgraced himself. Because basically Dukat has his total mental breakdown is why Damar becomes leader of the Cardassian Union. And really from that point on, you see him, I don't know if I'd say he resents being in power, but he certainly I never feel like he's fully comfortable with it. Right. And even right after the capture of Dukat, you see, for example, in Statistical Probabilities, which I just watched, and which is right after that six-episode arc at the beginning of Season 6, the genetically engineered people are saying that it seems like someone is forcing Damar to say these propaganda messages that he's sending out, presumably Weyoun. But it was interesting what you were saying with how so many earthly politicians seek to be in power. But there is this axiom that the politician or leader you most want is the one who doesn't want the job. And right. I think you could see that here. Damar never really seeks to be the leader of Cardassia in itself. It's the position that he finds himself in. And ultimately, I think that may lead into his reaction to what he sees and his ultimate decision to, you know, turn against the Dominion.
Definitely. But he has great qualities as a leader. I agree with you. He was thrust into it. He doesn't seem like someone who would seek power or seek to be the leader. He seems like someone who, well, he wants to have his comfortable life and drink his canar, right? Yeah. And have his women around, as we see a little bit there too. Mm-hmm. He wants to just play his role in the status quo of what the government was, as I was saying earlier. But once he's thrust into that position, he shows surprising skills as a leader to make hard decisions, necessary decisions, and to do what's best for his people, even if he doesn't immediately think this is what they should do. I mean, the fact that they were going to have to attack other Cardassians was something that, of course, his first reaction was, let's choose non-Cardassian targets. But Kira tells him, you're going to have to do it or you're going to lose. And he comes around, and the people around him still don't want to do it. And he says, nope, listen, tell us more. This is what we're going to do. And he does something which was shocking within DS9, and I think even shocking to Kira, which is to actually accept help from the very people who he had, as part of the Cardassian occupation, had held down for so long. And it's fascinating to see the Bajorans helping the Cardassians fight a resistance war against the Dominion after it's just turning the table on them. And then if you go into the literature, you find out that a Bajor also helps to rebuild Cardassia, which again is amazing after everything that the Cardassians did to them. But this had to be an extremely difficult thing for Damar to accept, to take help from Kira and from Bajor, but he did it, and I think it's the sign of a great leader. What did you think about him being willing to do that in the first place?
So, I think as you were saying, Damar does, I think he discovers within himself these leadership qualities. Certainly as, obviously he becomes leader of the Cardassian Union, and he's not just sort of a slack off. But on the other hand, as you were saying, once he is in power, he's just sort of drinking and just trying to get along. And I think what he finds is there's a memorable scene where in the final chapter where the men come down to arrest Damar and Kira and Garak. And then they end up killing their Jem'Hadar minders and pledging their loyalty to Damar. And Damar says, with men like you, how can we fail? And I think he discovers in himself this ability to lead people that he didn't know that he had. In the same way that he finds that, he, in his mind, he would rather kill this longtime friend that he has rather than betray Kira and the people who have been helping him. So I think it's a fascinating turnaround in his character. And he's, I think, one of the most interesting characters in Deep Space Nine for just that reason, because he really does change. And I think he didn't, a little bit like if you're familiar with the story of Beckett, where he seemed to kind of be, Beckett is this, the, he became the Archbishop of Canterbury during the reign of Henry II. And he was a friend of Henry and was sort of listless until he was made the archbishop, and then found himself strongly opposing the king because he finally found this thing that he had a calling to. And I think in the same way, Damar had, been a loyal member of the Cardassian military and government, but he never really found his calling or his true capability or niche until he found himself in this role of leading the rebellion.
Yeah, that's an excellent example. Talking more about the working with the Bajorans here, they say the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? And there's a reason why we say that. And we see Cardassia doing what Damar is doing here with Kira a number of times, where Cardassian dissident movements work together with the Federation or with former Bajoran terrorists or freedom fighters, however you want to look at it. And of course, Garak as well. And Garak has just a very... It's always interesting to see the interplay between Garak and other Cardassians when they have to work together. Because with Garak, you feel he knows how the Cardassian game works. He also has a love for his people, but he also, I think, doesn't agree with everything. Maybe it's living away from Cardassia for so long, he doesn't view it the same way. He has an outside perspective on it now, which influences what he does. But the Cardassians have to work with people like this from time to time. And these tend to be alliances of convenience rather than ideology. But what do you see here in terms of them being based on idea of common enemies, or how these partnerships work to advance the Cardassian underground?
Well, it's interesting that they do seem to partner with these different entities who, otherwise they might be quite opposed to. And Garak, to me, is a particularly interesting case. When you see in early in the seventh season where he has his attacks of claustrophobia that Ezri yeah. Dax tries to help him with, and what bothers him is, I guess like we were talking about with Damar earlier, that he's contributing information that's leading directly to the deaths of the fellow Cardassians, but he seems to feel that it contributes to these greater goals of the Cardassia he wants to see. But if we go back earlier, he has an interesting involvement with both Natima Lang and Kani Gamor. In Lang's case, his government had apparently, it seems like they were offering him that if he just killed Professor Lang, that he'd be allowed to come back to Cardassia, but instead he ends up allowing them to escape and, killing the other soldiers who had been sent to apprehend them. And then later he does the same thing with Gamor. So while Garak has served the government before, I think he, and maybe because he has been living with the Federation, he seems to have learned these lessons earlier than, say, a Damar did. But there are times when, obviously like in the Lang case where he was enlisted to work against Lang herself, that it seems like he could kind of come down on either side. And in fact, Gamora tells Kira at the end of Second Skin never to trust Garak. So sometimes I think there are these people, Cardassian or otherwise, who, as you see with earthly resistance movements, that for whatever reason, at that particular moment, you have a common enemy and you end up working together. Obviously, the U.S. and the Soviets fighting the Germans was very much an example of that.
Yeah.
So I think they, you know, like any intelligent resistance movement would, they seize upon those opportunities when they see it as convenient. And sometimes it is with people who you were very recently fighting with, as in the case with Kira helping the Mars movement.
And you see that with the Federation, the Klingons, the Romulans, and then ultimately the Cardassians against the Dominion at the end of the series as well.
Yeah, and these are all entities that I think every combination of those has probably fought a war with each other. I don't know if there was a Romulan-Cardassian war, but every other one I can think of has had wars, so that they all come together in this moment to fight their greater enemy is an interesting point, and definitely does underscore that concept you mentioned, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, can be dominant at certain times, and that's something that's definitely expressed through the Cardassian underground movements.
Most definitely. You know, it sounds like we have described the plot of an entire TV show as the main plot, right? This is what this show was about, was the Cardassian underground. But actually what we've talked about today is one little thread within DS9 that is really not a major thread.
Yeah.
It only really crops up as being anything major right at the end of the series. Isn't that amazing?
That's I think the thing that makes DS9 so special is to borrow some words from another Star Trek series, that it has such a rich tapestry of threads that you can pull on any one of them and delve so deep into it on something that, as you said, is like really a pretty minor component of the greater show as a whole. I think just speaks to the depth of the writing and the enduring legacy of Deep Space Nine, and that's why we're still here talking about it over 20 years later.
And we also should say that TNG did a nice job of establishing what kind of people the Cardassians were in order to allow DS9 to then build this entire story about their government, about the occupation of Bajor, about the way that they would oppress dissidents within their society and plant the seeds for this underground movement in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you could easily do Deep Space Nine without, you know, those episodes that featured the Cardassians, but at the same time, I think it would be much poorer for it to not have the Wounded and Chain of Command and those great TNG episodes that focus on the Cardassians. And especially with O'Brien becoming such a key part of Deep Space Nine, I think taking out the Wounded from TNG would definitely lessen the overall totality of the DS9 experience.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, DS9 would work without that backstory, but it really does help to set it up, because if you're like me and you view all of Star Trek as one long story, regardless of what series the episodes are part of, then it does make that timeline much, much richer and makes that world seem more real.
Yeah, definitely. I think Star Trek is always better taken as a whole, and while each show and each episode can stand on its own to some extent, it just becomes much more deeply layered tapestry of ideas when taken all together.
Well, Daniel, it's really been a great discussion today. Before we wrap up here, do you have any final thoughts on the subject of the Cardassian Underground?
I think that you can just take this in endless directions. You know, the motivations and of a character like Damar or Maritza are so deep and they're so different from each other, and yet they ultimately sort of end up pursuing a set of actions that result in similar goals. I think it speaks to the rich nature of this Cardassian society that the writers of Deep Space Nine created. And as we've been discussing, I think the fact that we can be talking about this over 20 years later and be relating it to events that in the news that literally happened a few weeks ago. And I think that's why you can easily make an argument that Deep Space Nine is one of the best or the best Star Trek and science fiction shows ever created.
I agree. That's why we do the Orb.
Yeah, that's why we're here.
But we do love all of Star Trek. So it's not, we're not here just to say that DS9 is the best, but it really, really is possibly the richest part of the Star Trek universe. The writing is so, so layered that it's just wonderful to dig into.
Yeah, and it just stands the test of time.
Well, Daniel, thank you again so much for sitting in for Matthew here today and for putting together this topic for us. Before I let you go, where can people find you if they want to share their thoughts on what we talked about today or talk Star Trek with you?
Well, Chris, people can find me at Daniel Handlin, that's Handlin, @gmail.com. You can talk to me about Star Trek or anything that's on your mind. And you can also find me, I was in the Ready Room this week and hopefully in other shows in the future.
We'll definitely have you back. And yeah, we had a fun time on the Ready Room. We talked about the Doomsday Machine, and that episode will be out right around the same time as this one. So everyone go check that out as well. If you want to hear us talk about a giant hand-rolled sushi furnace in space.
Sounds frightening. Sounds like it's right out of hell.
It is right out of hell. I saw it. All right. Well, thanks again, Daniel.
Hey, Chris.
Well, I really enjoyed talking about the Cardassian Underground with Daniel today, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And we go to the theater. I still remember this, even though I was only four. I still remember this. We go to the theater and we're watching it. And then that Klingon dog shows up on screen. And I'm like, what the frack is that? Get me out of here right now.
Earl Grey.
He would have excellent bedside manner. Here is a joke I know.
Would you like a Sumerian sunset? It is pretty. It will lift you from your terminal case of gout.
Choo!
The Ready Room.
I think that she is picturing him in the au naturel division of synchronized swimming.
Captain Fine.
Which is not an Olympic sport, but they are considering it as a demonstration sport for the Rio de Janeiro games coming up.
The Orb.
Is it this thing like where women like bad boys or something? Does Descartes have a Harley that I don't know about?
I think he must.
I don't know.
You know, he rides around on a Harley. He's just breaking hearts all over the place.
To the journey!
He says, yeah, they want me to read. They're saying it's mine if I want it, but I don't want to do it. And she, like, jumps out of her chair and, like, shakes him. She's like, what? Are you kidding? This is Star Trek! Are you kidding? You would be made for life!
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I thought you were going to do a Brandon Braga voice.
It's really hard to do a Brandon Braga voice.
That's pretty good.
It's
right
gotta
there.
Be, you know, it's gotta be kind of quiet.
Literary Treks.
Again, it was originally published as a scroll form and then later as a codex book, and now both in print and electronic form in the 24th century. And this particular edition of it has an introduction, an afterword, and modern commentary by a 24th century Klingon novelist named Karatak.
Continuing mission.
Goal was to try to get as much Trek content into people's hands and to let people explore the Trek universe with their own spaceship and build their own crew in the way they want, customize and design, and just, you know, to be in your own Star Trek world.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find them pretty much everywhere you get your podcasts. That could be iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. We're on Spreaker, BlackBerry, Swell. We're even on SoundCloud now. We're pretty much everywhere. Just search for Trek.fm or the name of the show that you want to listen to, and we should pop right up. You can also go to our website and stream the show from the webpage, and you can grab the RSS feed and pop that into your favorite third-party podcatcher as well. Another way for you to sample the full spectrum of programming on Trek FM is to subscribe to the Trek FM Complete Master Feed. That feed contains every episode of every show we do. So if you listen to a lot of our different shows, or you just want to find out what other hosts are talking about, it's a great way to do it in one place. And you'll find that on iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn. Just search for it wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll find that there as well. And if you enjoy the shows, please take a moment to leave us a star rating and a written review in iTunes. You can also leave us reviews on Stitcher now, and you can leave comments on SoundCloud. And we'd love to hear from you and hear what you think about the shows. One person who has shared their thoughts with us about the orb is Brad Alexander in Virginia. Brad wrote us a wonderful long message about our discussion of the changing face of evil. Now, Brad, I'm going to save the majority of your message for when Matthew is back, because I would actually like to read it with Matthew here and let Matthew share his thoughts on it as well. But everyone, basically what Brad said was great commentary on the changing face of evil. I like the fact that you are doing the final story arc. This episode is really an emotional roller coaster for me. It makes me sad and is one of my many favorites at the same time, so I thought I might share a few thoughts on it. And then things that Brad mentioned were the Breen attack on Earth. Matthew and I speculated on how the Breen got to Earth so quickly and Earth didn't know they were coming. And Brad mentions Doolittle's raid, which was a one-time bombing of Tokyo during World War II, as being a possible inspiration for the Breen attack on Earth. And I think that's a great example. It's one I hadn't thought of, but it does fit in with the fact that Ronald D. Moore did like to use historical events like this as inspirations, both on DS9 and in Battlestar Galactica. So great point there, Brad. Brad also mentioned Sisko's tiredness in the episode, which is something that we talked about, and had some thoughts on Cassidy and Sisko as well. He said, "You guys are doing a great job with the final arc. I hope you're going to do some of the other story arcs in DS9 as well, like maybe the Kira Dukat thread throughout the series, the Klingon War series, or even looking at how Dukat changed through the series." And Brad, I think those are great ideas. I'm sure we will do things like that as we go along. There are so many great arcs to talk about in Deep Space Nine, but I really do like your idea of picking out some of these arcs that occur throughout the series, not necessarily in back-to-back episodes or not even necessarily in the same season, but things that we can piece together. I think that's a great idea. And we are definitely doing a Dukat show. We're going to be doing a big Dukat show. It's coming. We're just waiting to line up a couple of things and get that in place. So everyone who wants to hear about Dukat, it's coming. So Brad, thanks again for your message. I will revisit this message when Matthew is back, and we will talk in a little more detail about the things that you wrote about Doolittle's raid, Sisko's tiredness, Cassidy and Sisko, and more. For everyone else, if you would like to share your thoughts with us, we would love to hear from you. There are a number of ways that you can do that. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. That's how Brad contacted us. You can have all the room you want to write a message, and that will come to us by email. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. On Google Plus, we have a community now. Just search G+ communities for TrekFM and you'll find us. You can even send us a voicemail. If you go to the website and go to a show page, in the left sidebar, this is on our new website design, you will see a SpeakPipe widget. And if you just click that, you can use your webcam's microphone to record a message and send it right to us. And it even works with smartphones as well. And if you'd like to find Matthew, who cannot speak for himself today as he's not here, his username on Twitter is MattRushing02. And of course, Matthew and I also do Literary Treks together, our show about Star Trek books and comics where we interview authors. And if you'd like to find me, I'm on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me anywhere in social media with that same username. I think I use it universally. But Twitter is the best place to hit me up. That's where I really like to chat with people. And if you send me a message, I will reply to you. So feel free to contact me and talk about Deep Space Nine. I would love to talk to you. Elsewhere on the network, besides doing Literary Treks with Matthew, you'll find me on Warp 5, which is all about Enterprise, Continuing Mission, where I interview the people who create Star Trek fan series and independent productions, Matterstream, which is about the world inspired by Star Trek, also Hyperchannel, which is our daily news show, where I spend about 15 minutes with you and share my thoughts on some of the stories in the world of Star Trek for that day. And of course, there is The Ready Room, which I host together with other hosts from all over the network, and we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series on that show, as well as Star Trek news. So check those out. Would love to hear what you think about everything else that we're talking about in the world of Star Trek. Before I let you go, I would also like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. They are the best source for audiobooks that you'll find anywhere. They have over 150,000 titles waiting for you right now. They put hundreds of new titles up every single week in a wide range of categories. They do have a lot of Star Trek books up there. They also have lots of classics, new releases, business, humor, anything you want to listen to. They have great audio dramas as well. I've been listening to some audio dramas myself recently. In fact, I pulled out one of my all-time favorites, which is the BBC radio dramatization of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Apparently, I can't get enough Hitchhiker's Guide. I've been listening to it now for 20-something years. I've been reading it for 30-something years. Can't get enough of it. They have it there at Audible, though, and you can get it absolutely free or any book you want as a Trek FM listener, because we do have a special offer for you, which is one audiobook of your choice absolutely free. All you need to do is try Audible for a month. You just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. Choose the audiobook you want, and if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep that audiobook. But when you support Audible, you really, really do help us here at The Orb, because the money that we receive from Audible when you try out the service actually almost covers the cost of hosting The Orb for one entire month. We have 16 shows on the network, so we have a lot of expense to cover, and a simple act like trying out Audible really does make it possible for us to keep The Orb and all of our shows coming to you. So go try them out, audibletrial.com/trekfm. You're going to love it. We really do appreciate your support, and we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. Thanks again, everyone, for listening today. Matthew will be back soon. He is on a mission to the Great Northwest. He'll be away for a few weeks, but he will be back. He's not going anywhere. He says hello to everyone and invites you to join us again next time when we once again gaze into the orb.